Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and here we discuss the art and business of writing with writers, poets, literary agents, and editors. Today my guest is Chitra Banerjee Divakaruni, author of Sister of My Heart, published by Anchor, Division of Knopf. Chitra Divakaruni was born in Calcutta, India, and is an award-winning poet and novelist who lives in Houston with her husband and sons and teaches creative writing and English at the University of Houston. But soon she will be going on leave to move to Northern California, where she will be writing full-time. How wonderful! In 1995, her short story collection, Arranged Marriage, was awarded the Penn Oakland Josephine Miles Prize for Fiction, the Bay Area Book Reviewers Award for Fiction, and an American Book Award from the Before Columbus Foundation. Her other books include the best-selling Mistress of Spices and a book of poems, Leaving Yuba City. Welcome to Writers on Writing, Chitra.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Wonderful. Gosh, Sister of My Heart is written so poetically, and I recall something your agent told me a long time ago, that you were originally a poet. Is that true?
That's right. I have 4 books of poetry, and 3 of them came out before I wrote any fiction. So I think being a poet was very much at the center of my writing before I became a fiction writer.
So how was it then that you found your way to fiction?
I found that at a certain stage, particularly in my 3rd book of poetry, Black Candle, I found that my poems were becoming very narrative. I was becoming more and more interested in story and in character and in showing the growth of characters and the relationship of characters. And it seemed to me that fiction was the medium I needed to move into to allow that full expression.
Mm-hmm. So, Sister of My Heart, what was the genesis for that book?
Sister of My Heart grew out of a short story I had written for my 1st book of fiction, Arranged Marriage. And it was a story called The Ultrasound, where 2 women are pregnant, 2 cousins, one in the United States, one in India. And their pregnancies take very different courses and create a tragic situation for the woman in India. And I wrote that story, and then I went on to write The Mistress of Spices, but I kept thinking about those characters. You know, sometimes, and I've heard other writers say this too, characters seem to take off on a life of their own, and they won't let go of you.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the case with the 2 women in the ultrasound. I had to go back to their lives, and in fact, in Sister of My Heart, I go back to the beginnings of their lives. They're 8 years old when the book begins.
Yes.
And I imagine how their lives must have been and the ways through which they traveled to come to that point when they're both pregnant and a tragic situation occurs. And then, of course, the novel goes on beyond that as well.
So when you wrote it as a short story, did you have any inkling then that this was to become a novel?
No, I had no idea at all. A lot of times my writing surprises me, and in some ways that's what is so magical about writing, the realization that I'm not always in conscious control of what's coming, and that some of it comes from a very deep source within me.
Mm-hmm. Will you read a bit from the book?
Certainly. I thought I would read to you a little bit from fairly late in the book. This is when the 2 women have grown up and gone through arranged marriages. And Anju, who is the rebellious cousin, finds herself in the United States.
Okay.
And she has been looking forward to coming to the United States. Her husband, Sunil, has been telling her how wonderful it is here. And she comes to the Bay Area, to California, and this is some of her experience.
Okay.
I balance the bag of groceries on my hip and brush my short hair from my face as I try to unlock our apartment door. The key sticks in the lock, as usual, and I have to jiggle it. quite a feat, considering that I'm also holding on to Sunil's newly cleaned jacket. I can feel the bag of groceries beginning to slide. I make a frantic grab. There are eggs inside, and lose the jacket. The letters I just got out of our mailbox scatter all over the doormat. Bills, pizza coupons, a computer-generated flyer addressed to single resident. Under the Memorial Day sale announcements from Sears, I glimpse a distinctive cream envelope. My heart begins to beat unevenly, even before I see my name written in my mother's neat script, because lately there's been no good news from home at all. Shit, I say, bending awkwardly to pick things up. Shit. Of all the American terms I've avidly gleaned in the 3 years I've been here, it's my favorite. Its explosive, exact conciseness expresses how I feel a lot of the time. But I'm careful to use it only when Sunil isn't around, because he thinks it isn't ladylike. The door finally opens with a protesting creak, but I wait a bit before going in. Even now, I don't like walking into an empty apartment. There's something about the air, unpeopled and stagnant, like it's from the bottom of a well that dried up a long time ago, that makes me uncomfortable. That's when the longing for the house of my childhood shakes me the most. How irritated I used to be at the constant commotion. Milkmen, vegetable sellers, Ramur Ma shouting at the neighbor cat who'd snuck into the kitchen, Bishi calling me to go for my bath. Now I'd be glad to see even the gossiping tea-time aunties. Inside, I drop everything on the kitchen table and collapse on the couch. I've been out since morning. First, I took Sunil to the train station, then I went to my classes, then I caught up on some assignments at the library, then the grocery, then the dry cleaners. I'm in a terrible mood. Hunger always does that to me. That and the fact that there's nothing to eat unless I cook it first. Of the many realizations I've had since I came to America, the foremost one is that I hate cooking. Not that there's time to cook. I have to pick Sunil up from the station in 30 minutes, and it'll take me a good 15 just to get there. So, it'll have to be frozen burritos again. I know what Sunil's going to say. Well, he won't really say anything, but he'll give me that look, like his life is one big burden, and guess who's responsible. That look always provokes me into a fight, and tonight I don't want to. I've got to save my energies for the letter from India. So I drag myself off the couch and throw together onions and tomatoes and a few spices for a rice casserole to go with the burritos. I leave the stove on low, though Sunil's warned me that it's dangerous, wipe my hands on my jeans, and take the steps two at a time. Of course, I hit every red light on the way to the station, and the motorist behind me honks and yells, "Stupid Iranian," because I'm not quick enough to make a left turn before the signal changes. It's not what I imagined my American life would be like.
Thank you. If you've just tuned in, that was Chitra Devakaruni reading from Sister of My Heart into the book. This is 88.9 FM KUCI in Southern California. As you were reading, I was somehow reminded of a story I read in Arranged Marriage, which was the story, I wish I had the book with me, it was the story where the young woman comes to America to live with her aunt and uncle.
Oh, right.
And the aunt and the young woman are walking, and there is slush thrown in their faces from some boys on the street. And
right.
Later I read in something your publicist sent to me, something about that, that had happened to you, that experience had happened. And so I suddenly became interested in how much do you put your own life into your stories or into your novels, and was that more, did you do that more when you were first writing, and do you do it still?
Well, generally, I don't put much directly from my own experience into my writing. I just tend not to, because perhaps because it's hard for me to get critical distance on that.
Mm-hmm.
That story, though, Silver Pavements, Golden Roof.
Yes, that's it.
That incident and that story is almost, exactly taken from what happened to me. Oh, let's see, it was my second day in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, I had just moved to Chicago to live with some relatives, and this did happen. But it took me a good 15 years to be able to write about it, to get the distance to write about it. So perhaps I will. You know, every once in a while I do write things just because they've had such an important effect on me, and because they've made me see the world differently, and not just from my own point of view. I think when that incident occurred where the two women go out on the street and some white kids who are playing on the side of the street call them nigger, and then they throw slush at them.
Yes.
It made me realize something about the immigrant and how vulnerable the new immigrant is when he or she comes to a different country. And so, you know, I think it made me realize, once I got over the initial pain of the incident, a lot of things about my people in this country. And so it was very important for me to write about it.
Mm-hmm.
And like I was telling you before the interview, I'm finishing up a collection of short stories, which is going to be my next book. And there's one story there, although the story itself goes on to a different conclusion, it's based on one of my experiences when my youngest son was being born. I became very ill and nearly died in the hospital. And so there's a hospital story in there,
mm-hmm.
which I could never have written had it not happened to me.
Yes.
And yet it made me realize certain things about life and death that went beyond my own life.
Mm.
And therefore I needed to write about that.
It sounds like you go way into experience, and that may be why your fiction is so effective.
Thank you.
It seems that one thing writers do to that takes the power away is they don't allow themselves to go way into their work. Is that difficult for you? You seem like you're more of a shy person, and I'm curious if...
Well, you know, it is difficult when I go way into experience, and it's not necessarily personal experience. Sometimes it'll be something that I overhear, or maybe something I read in one of the Indian American papers, or something that has happened to a friend. But for me, the whole enterprise of writing is very centrally based on imagining that life that I'm writing about and experiencing that life in the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
If I cannot experience it as I'm writing it, then I feel the writing doesn't come alive. Now, this is how I feel. I know many writers write in a whole different way.
Mm-hmm. So when you say experience it to make it come alive, what exactly do you mean? Do you mean feel the emotion of the situation? Do you mean that you fuse yourself, emerge with the characters so that you are them?
Yes, I think I mean both of those things.
Uh-huh.
And I think in pieces that I've felt really strongly about, that I felt were successful, yes, I do become, as it were, the character. And that's why a lot of my work is in the I voice, because the first person allows me to really get into the psyche of the character. And in Sister of My Heart, of course, this has a particular ironic twist, because each chapter is in the voice of one of the sisters. And so some of the time I'm with Anju, and some of the time I'm with Sudha.
Mm-hmm.
And there's tensions there, because Anju, who, as I said, is the rebellious one, she's the modern one, she sees the world very differently. And Sudha, who's the beautiful, traditional, dutiful daughter, who loves the old stories and the old legends, she sees her world very differently. And so there's a lot of tension between these two visions of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And as I moved from one to the other, I had to deal with that in the writing.
Just before we went on the air, you started telling me about one of your stories was just nominated for the Best American Short Story Volume 1999.
That's right.
Tell me more.
It came out just a few months back.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a story titled Mrs. Dutta Writes a Letter,
mm-hmm.
which was originally published in the Atlantic Monthly. And that is going to be one of the stories in my upcoming collection, which is titled The Unknown Errors of Our Life. And one of the themes in that story, and I find that I'm very interested in this topic right now and feel very strongly about it, is that what happens is to explore, I should say, because I think, you know, this is, it's a complex topic and it's hard to arrive at any conclusion. But I'm very interested in exploring what happens to the old people when their children immigrate.
Hmm.
And what happens to that generation whose children have immigrated to America and who are then left with one of two choices, either to follow their children to America, which they don't necessarily want to do, they never really wanted to leave their homeland and come here, or to live in their homeland, live their lifestyle, but be very lonely.
Mm-hmm.
And Mrs. Dutta is one of these women who decides to come and join her son in California and then is faced with a number of challenges.
Hmm. What happened with you and your family when you moved here?
Well, when I moved for graduate studies, so I was fairly young. And my parents, they wanted to move, actually. My father wanted to come and work here for a number of years. So they did. But my mother, in some ways, I guess she was like Mrs. Dutta, who was very, very much in love with the lifestyle of India. There's a particular grace and ease of lifestyle over there that my mother really missed when she came over. She missed the extended family.
Mm-hmm.
She missed the long afternoons where you could get together and chat with friends. She missed the temples. She missed a lot of things. So ultimately, she decided to go back. You know, my parents did go back. And now that my father is not alive anymore, even though my mother is all alone in India, she has decided that that's what she wants.
Hmm.
And that creates, of course, other tensions. And, you know, you feel like you gain something and you give up something.
Yeah.
And we miss her here, and I know she misses us there.
Hmm.
But it's just one of those byproducts of immigration.
Right. This is 88.9 FM. My guest is Chitra Divakaruni, author of Sister of My Heart. I've been to India several times, and I would imagine that it would be a difficult place to leave. There, it's such a rich culture. I still long to return. And what do you miss about India?
That is a really complex question, and the answer changes as I live here longer, and the answer changes from day to day. Actually, I think one of the things I definitely miss is the sense of family, the sense of extended family. Even now, my mother has gone back to our ancestral village to live. And when I go back and I take my children back to the ancestral village where we have so many relatives and who all come to visit us and who all invite us to their homes, and in some ways it's almost as though we never left.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of, that sense of a clan, I think, is something that I'll never have over here. So I do miss that, and I miss that for my children because they really won't grow up with that.
Mm-hmm.
Where you could go from, you know, your home to another home, and that was also your home in
right.
some ways. That was also part of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard to create over here.
Yeah.
And I think I just miss the landscape a lot. The landscape to me is so beautiful. The landscape of Bengal, where I grew up, it's very green, it's very lush. I miss that a lot. There's a lot of unspoiled nature even now in the Bengal countryside.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why I write about it a lot. Much of Sister of My Heart, not much, but significant portions of Sister of My Heart is set in a small town in Bengal.
Hmm. Back to short stories. Now, I also recall something your agent told me about your first book, that she sold it based on three short stories. Am I getting that right?
That's right. And that was right in the beginning of my fiction writing career. And my writing teacher had seen these stories, which were, you know, they were like the first stories I'd ever written. And he liked them very much. And he sent them on to Sandra Dykstra, who is my very wonderful agent. And she wanted to sign me on the basis of those stories. And she took them to New York and sold them. And then she called me and she said, I've sold your book. And I was so surprised. I said, what book, Sandy? Because, those were the only stories I had. And then I wrote the other stories kind of around those stories to create a central theme. And I think in Arranged Marriage, the central theme was that of changing relationships, not just in a marriage, but in a woman's life, all kinds of relationships would change because she has come into a whole different environment, into a whole different world.
Yeah, it's so unlikely that to sell a book based on stories. It's really amazing and wonderful that that can happen.
Well, and that's why I like to share that story, because, you know, I think people are always talking about, with good reason, about how publishers are so, you know, money hungry and agents will only take on what they think will be a best-selling novel. And my experience has just been so positive. Sandra has been a wonderful agent and really looked at my stories. And at that time, neither she nor I thought that I was going to write a novel at all. I wasn't interested in exploring the novel form. And my publisher took me on the same way. And my publisher, Doubleday, has been very supportive of me and has published since then everything I've written, including Leaving Yuba City, which is a collection of poems. And as you know, the big publishers really don't like to do that.
Mm-mm.
But they've been very faithful to me. So, and again, I share this with our listeners just to show people that there are wonderful people both in the world of agents and in the world of publishers. And one has to keep the faith, and one has to just write as a writer, write what we love and do the best with it that we can.
Yes. Yes, exactly. I'm glad you said that. It can be very depressing for writers because of what they hear, or perhaps they've gotten a rejection letter, and it does work out.
Yes, it does. And I really do believe that even if one goes through a number of rejections, and, you know, we all know the stories of wonderful books which went through 30 or 40 or 50 rejections before they became, like, major successes. So one has to keep that in mind, that for many of us, well, I can speak only for myself, the reason we went into writing was because it was a passion. We had to do it. And there was a deep satisfaction that was separate from however much money we would ever make off of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one just has to remember it.
We're going to take a short break. Chitra, don't go away. And listeners, don't you go away either. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Chitra Divakaruni, author of Sister of My Heart. Please stay tuned.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. You know, little darling, from one belt a day, let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine, California. And I should say that the opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the University of California Board of Regents. Shitra,
yes.
I wanted to talk about short stories versus novels. For you, what is the difference between the two forms?
Well, you know, each form is so wonderful in its own way and so challenging. As I write more short stories and novels, I find that I'm just craving, you know, the tip of the iceberg. There's so much craft that is possible in both of these media. I think what is wonderful about the short story is it's very much like a watercolor. You have a little bit of space, and you have to sketch in things very deftly. And yet, the effect can be just as powerful as that of a large oil painting, which is how I think of a novel, where lots of things are going on at once, and there's layers and layers of strokes that you bring in, and the effect is that of a panorama.
So does it take a different state of mind for you to write one or the other, or does it have to do more with, say, the idea, and you say, well, this idea is a small idea, or this idea will take 400 pages to flesh out?
I think it is the idea and the situation, although the mental stance is also different. When I'm writing short stories, in some ways, I'm closer to my vision as a poet, because for me, short stories work more through images. Much is left unsaid, much more is left unsaid in the short story. And we move from one point to another through ellipses. There will be a lot of unspoken things, I think, and things that I don't show, things that I expect my readers to be able to imagine. And also, the short story being a shorter form can be more experimental. I can try things in the short story that I could not in the novel. For example, one of the short stories in Arranged Marriage, titled The Word Love, is in second person. So it's a you in the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it's a you in the short story. And I don't think I could do that over an entire novel. I don't think readers could hold on to that either.
Mm-hmm. I think the only novel that I've ever even seen that in, or that perhaps even ever worked, was Bright Lights, Big City.
That's right.
And since then, nothing.
Yes. And that novel, if I recall right, has these very short and snappy chapters,
mm-hmm.
which are almost, you know, poem-like in some ways.
So then, poetry, does that then, when do you know something is a poem? When do you know that, or is it...
Well, I think for me, I know something wants to come out as a poem when I begin to see it in very, you know, in very terse images, in very concentrated images, and also when the phrases begin to come out with a certain rhythm,
mm-hmm.
and the rhythm makes me realize that that is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't always know. Sometimes I'll write something as a poem, and then I realize that I haven't explored a certain part of its potential. For example, my novel, The Mistress of Spices, I wrote it first as a series of poems set in an Indian grocery. And then, you know, I realized that there was a lot more here that I needed to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went back and began to write it as a novel.
Interesting.
But perhaps for that reason, I think of that as a very poetic novel. It's based on a lot of images, and a lot of voices, and there are a lot of elliptical statements there as well.
Hmm. How do you deal with reviews? Do you read them? Do you pay attention to them? Do you let them influence you and make you feel wonderful?
Or Or
do you take them to heart if someone says, oh, everything's really, really, really wonderful except, oh, this one thing? Do you focus on the really, really wonderful, or do you focus on the one thing?
Well, it depends on what stage I'm at. If the book has just come out and I'm going on a big tour, like with Sister of My Heart, I had to go on a very long tour right after the book came out, and it was very strenuous. And author tours are very stressful for me because, as you noticed earlier, I'm kind of a shy and private person.
Mm-hmm.
And I really don't like to go out there. I mean, it's not that I don't like to. It's difficult for me. I do like to meet my readers. But all of that traveling and staying in hotels and going through airports and, you know, talking to interviewers who maybe haven't read or haven't understood your book, it's difficult. It's an exercise in humility. And so I remember before I started Sister of My Heart, my editor and I decided that I would only be sent the positive reviews. So she only sent me the ones that made me feel really good and confident and made me feel that, yes, the whole world out there loved me and loved my book. But she held on to the others because I did want to see them. And after the tour was over and I was feeling more settled, I looked at all of them carefully to see what people had to say. And then, of course, you have to be really objective about it, because sometimes a reviewer comes from a very different place from where you are and hasn't really understood the enterprise. And sometimes reviewers have their own agendas, which might be whatever, political or something else.
Mm-hmm.
And their agenda is coming through their work. But then there are those really good and perceptive reviewers who say, well, I like this, this, and this about the book, but this was a weakness. And I do want to be able to see that when someone reviews my work in that way and learn from it. So, you know, it's difficult. I think sometimes it takes me a whole year after a book has come out because you're so close to your work in the beginning that anything anyone says, it's like a direct affront. It's like you had a baby and someone looks into the cradle and says, oh, what an ugly baby. <You know? laughs> And so I think it took me a good year before I could really look at all of the reviews with any kind of objectivity. And I was very fortunate because most of the reviews were very good. But I didn't want to miss out on some of the constructive criticism. I wanted to be able to use it for my next work.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting in talking about your shyness. Now, what does a shy person do when People Magazine visits them? February 15th, 1999, you're in People Magazine. How was that?
I know, that was kind of a surreal experience. I live a very simple kind of life, so it was very unusual. Actually, and that was actually the second time People Magazine and photographed me. So the first time was even more surreal.
Oh, that's funny. That's wonderful. That's wonderful, though, to write literary fiction and poetry and have People Magazine come to your house is a wonderful thing.
Well, I was very appreciative for that reason, because I think, you know, one of my hopes is to write the kind of work that is literary, that does not compromise on art and craft and vision, and yet have it be accessible. I feel very strongly about this. I think, you know, good literature needs to be accessible, because otherwise people just won't come to it. And in this, I go back to, you know, the literature of India, the traditional literature, the epics, which are wonderful and have a very high literary quality, but they're very, very accessible on one level or another, so that everyone can come to them and enjoy and learn something from them and have their lives changed by them. And that is the ideal which I hold in mind. So I think everything that happens in our literary world today or in our world of media today that brings high literature into the popular media span, as it were, is wonderful.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm not saying I'm writing high literature. I'm just saying I'm aspiring to.
You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. My guest is Shitra Devakaruni, author of Sister of My Heart. Have you given thought to commercial concerns? And I guess this probably is more fitting to talk about before your book, your first book came out, and certainly before your novels. Did you wonder if perhaps you were writing too poetically, or if your stuff was too literary? Or did you just kind of go with the writing and say, it doesn't matter?
You know, I just went with the writing. And what I wanted to write was, I wanted to make my work as original as it could be. And I wanted to really capture the characters and their situations. And since I've been a poet, I've been very sensitive to words and the usage of words, the sounds of words, and all of that. So I paid a lot of attention to that. And I didn't really think too much about whether it was too poetic. But, you know, I tried to make it accessible right from the beginning. Because I would think something like this. You know, I would think about my mother, who has a good education, who knows a fair amount of English, and who is an intelligent reader, but who is not necessarily a very highly literary or sophisticated reader in that sense. And I would think, well, I want people just like my mother to be able to pick up my book and enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, I had that idea in the back of my mind that I was writing for the ordinary woman who I think is much more intelligent than the media gives her credit for being. Because generally when you say, you know, oh, books for women readers, there's kind of a put down in that.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to take that put down out of that expression. Because I think women are wonderful readers.
I'm curious about your extracurricular activities. You volunteer, I read, for various women's organizations, hotlines and such. And I wonder how this came about, or perhaps the question is how this works. Or does this work in your writing? Does this work into your writing? And I'm thinking of something a poet guest said some time ago on my show, and that was to get out of your studio or away from your desk and do something in the world if you want your writing to, not improve, but perhaps have more texture.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about
that?
Well,
you know, I started working with women, actually with battered women and women in abusive situations a long time before I started writing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just been a big part of my life. I mean, I started doing that when I was in graduate school, and I continued volunteering. And then in 1991, along with a group of friends, I helped to found Maitri, which is the first South Asian hotline on the West Coast, and which has grown into a very powerful organization right now and has helped many, many women. And, you know, I'm very happy to say that and that I've been a part of it for many years. And currently, since I've been in Houston, I work with DIA, which is a similar organization. So that has just been a very, very big part of my life. I feel very strongly about that. I feel very strongly that women must be allowed to live lives of dignity, that abuse is just not acceptable for anybody. But since I work with women, particularly for women, and, you know, I put a lot of my energies into working in that field. So I can't say that I did that to help my writing, or that the writing came first and then this came. But I can definitely say that it's had an enormous effect on my writing and on my life. It's just made me sensitive to so many issues that I glossed over before. It's just made me realize so many things about people. It's made me see the enormous silent courage in the lives of many women, whom I admire and honor for that. I think it's also made me realize that sometimes the reality of a situation is very different from what it looks like on the surface.
Yes.
And all of these understandings have helped my writing and given it depth and complexity.
Hmm. Talk a bit about your craft. Your writing has quite a distinct tone, and of course everyone always wants to know, does it come out that way, or do you labor over the craft? Do you revise endlessly?
I do revise a lot, and I teach creative writing here at the University of Houston, and I'm always telling my students that revision is so important. Revision, intelligent revision, is the best gift we can give ourselves as writers, because it allows us to polish, it allows us to be patient, it allows us to have vision. When something comes out, it's kind of in, you know, it's in its white heat of creativity, and it's very exciting, but you don't have a very good perspective on it, because you're so close to it at that point. So, you know, my ideal way of doing something is to finish it and put it away for 6 months and then go back to it. And I'm always amazed by what I see in it 6 months later.
So during that 6 months, do you go back to perhaps something else you'd put aside, or you start
right.
a new project?
Right. I'd either go back to something that I'd put aside earlier, or I'd start a new project.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So, for example, I'm working on a novel right now, and then when the novel was half done, halfway through the novel, I went back to my completed manuscript of short stories, which I had put away for 6 months, and I'm doing a complete revision of that.
Hmm. You said intelligent revision. What do you mean?
I think one has to be very careful about revision. A lot of times when we revise, we're doing it in response to outside criticism. Let's say a story has been workshopped or something, or, you know, someone, a writer friend, has given you suggestions. And often our first tendency is to do everything that we've been asked to do. You know, change everything the way the comments are telling us to. And I think we have to stop and say to ourselves, well, what is this story intending? How will this change the story? We have to have a vision, because most revision will improve the story, but some revision will make it lose its edge. Some revision will make it lose its authenticity and its voice and its originality. So we have to be careful. And also, one of the most difficult things, I think, for me as a writer, is to know when something has been fully revised. And when I know that if I go beyond this, I'll start ruining the product.
How do you know this?
It's difficult. I have to kind of, you know, go by feel.
One of those elusive things.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes with a piece, I know that very well. And sometimes with a piece, I have to kind of keep going back to it and asking myself about it.
Well, with critiques then, or say in a workshop, how do you know what to pay attention to? Do you pay attention to the word someone saying that echoes something perhaps you've been thinking? Do you listen to consensus? What do you do with all of those opinions that come at you, whether it's you receiving a critique from, say, friends, or whether it's your students? What do you tell them?
Well, sometimes what people will say will be what you're thinking of in your head and what you had doubts about. And so when two or three people say the same thing that you were thinking maybe yourself, that's a sure indication that that's something that needs to be worked on. And then I think you do have to listen. You know, when you're in a workshop, you have to just trust the intelligence of the other readers. But when you have developed a group maybe of writer friends that you trust, then it's really very good, because you know what their strengths are, what they're good at seeing in your work. And then you know how to take their comments.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, in terms of teaching then, how does it affect your writing?
You know, I love teaching. I love being with students. I learn a lot, I think, as I was teaching my students at the University of Houston. And our students here are very, very smart. This program was recently rated the second in the nation. So these are very smart writers. Some of them, I think, will be far better writers than I am. So I learned a great deal from them, and by looking at their work and by how they respond to each other in workshop, and particularly with the ones I advised where we really talked about the work in great depth and detail, it made me think about questions that relate to my own writing. And some of the problems they were having were problems that I was having as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, time is the problem.
Yes.
When you really give yourself to teaching, it takes so much of your time. And I would find myself really struggling between writing and teaching. And, of course, my work in the community, and I have two little boys. So it was a big juggling act. So I'm really very glad that we are going to California now, and I'm going to take some time off to write full time.
Hmm. Yeah. Things that are important to you that you need to keep in mind about writing. What sort of things keep you going during times that perhaps the words aren't coming so easily, or that you need to inspire yourself?
Well, I think as I've been writing, and now I've been writing for a good 12 or 13 years, writing has become just such a big part of my life that I say to myself, what's the alternative? If I don't write, I feel as though something very rich and wonderful and energizing and powerful and beautiful has gone out of my life. So that just is not an option for me. So when I'm going through difficult times, I try to inspire myself either by reading the works of writers whom I love or by reading work that I have written where I've done a good job to make myself feel confident to see, well, what did I do there that maybe I can pick up on over here with this piece where I'm stuck. Or I'll do journal writing, or I'll do editing of a completed piece when I can't create new work. Or sometimes I'll read, you know, some really bad writers, and then that'll give me confidence. And I'll say, I can write better than that.
Well, it has been a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Barbara.
And I appreciate your time, and look forward to your next work, and have a wonderful move.
Thank you, thank you. Yes, the next work will be coming out in April of 2001, and I'm hoping I will be in the Los Angeles area.
That would be great. I'd love to have you back on.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Chitra Divakaruni, author of Sister of My Heart. Next week, my guest will be former Doubleday editor Harriet Rubin, author of Soloing and founder of iVillage.com. Writers on Writing is internet accessible at KUCI.org. The show's schedule is now posted on my website, so if you want to know who's coming on in June and part of July, go to writersonwriting.com. And you can also email me at writersonwriting@AOL.com. I'd like to leave you with a quote by Flannery O'Connor. She said, "You may write for the joy of it, but the act of writing is not complete in itself. It has to end in its audience." This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Thank you for listening.